Case number 15-3075, United States of America versus Nazir bin Abdelaziz Trabelsi, also known as Nazir bin Abdelaziz Trabelsi, also known as Abu QA QA Appellant. Ms. Petras for the appellant, Mr. Smith for the appellee.
May it please the court, Mary Petras on behalf of Nazir Trabelsi.
Good morning.
I would like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal. Mr. Trabelsi was charged in Belgium with the same offenses that are charged in the indictment here. And the prosecution of the indictment violates the extradition treaty. The treaty prohibits extradition when a person sought has been found guilty, convicted, or acquitted for the same offenses as in the requested state. The record unequivocally demonstrates that Mr. Trabelsi was charged with conspiracy, not just attempts, but conspiracy in Belgium, and that the district court erred when it distinguished the offenses based on this distinction.
Let me ask a question. Let's suppose that the Belgian courts had interpreted the treaty and the facts here as you're arguing. Let's suppose they said that double jeopardy is based on, you know, the same evidence, and even if it's the Blockberger test, we find that it meets the Blockberger test and it's double jeopardy, but that the Minister of Justice said, you know, I agree with that legal analysis, but as a matter of international comity, I am going to allow the extradition to go forward and send Mr. Trabelsi to the United States for foreign relations purposes. Could we review that decision?
Yes. If he's extradited based on the treaty. If he's not extradited based on the treaty, but the parties decide to forego the treaty and there's some other provision or there's some other way in which they get custody of Mr. Trabelsi, then he would not have the protections of the treaty. But he was brought here under the protections of the treaty. And once the treaty is used to extradite, then he gets all of the protections that are in there. And under the treaty, both parties have agreed mutually not to prosecute the same offenses.
So under my hypothetical, we could review that decision. We could say that the Minister of Justice shouldn't have accommodated the United States?
If the extradition takes place under the treaty, yes.
But I guess, Ms. Petras, another way of putting it is, does Belgium have the authority to waive Article 5?
I don't think that the Belgian if the means by which the person is being transferred from one state to another is the extradition treaty, then the parties that have signed off on that provision cannot just simply ignore it. So I do.
Why not? If they say we have this agreement and we have required certain conditions, but in this instance, this condition is one we're going to waive.
That would be no different than saying that there is a law that says people can't rob banks, but we're going to decide that these people can rob this bank. The treaty is the law like no other. So the United States can't waive its own laws, and the United States and Belgium can't waive the law that they've agreed to, which is the treaty. And here, because the treaty's been ratified and the treaty becomes the law of the United States, so it can't simply be ignored.
Can you direct us to, as it was my understanding that signatories to a treaty actually could waive terms. And I wonder if can you, I mean, you've suggested that, well, one version, one aspect of that is just that a treaty becomes the law of the land, and so how could it be subject to waiver? But is there anything more specific on non-waiver in a circumstance like this?
I would have to think about that because that issue was not raised by the government. And because, as a matter of fact, Mr. Trabelsi was brought here pursuant to the treaty, right. So he did come here with all of the protections that the treaty provides.
And we're just sort of trying to explore our jurisdiction. You know, what authority do we have? How much deference? Do we have authority to second-guess what Belgium did, and so we're trying to understand the range of what Belgium might have been understanding itself to have done.
I think that the court In this particular case, the only issue is whether or not, because he was brought by the treaty, the only issue is whether or not the treaty was violated, and then does he have the protections of the treaty. The cases that the government has cited to suggest that the court should not enforce the treaty, that that's between the United States and Belgium, are cases that address different issues. And the government has criticized us because there's no issues that's sort of directly on point on the double jeopardy issue, but there are, the cases sort of fall into two different categories. One set addressing the dual criminality question, and one set addressing the doctrine of speciality. The double jeopardy issue is much closer to the doctrine of speciality issue than it is to the dual criminality question, because the dual criminality question is a question of can this person be extradited, and it's based solely on the law of the requested state. But the question of doctrine of speciality is can this person be prosecuted like this? And the question is, does the treaty allow for this type of prosecution? The issue is sort of the same for double jeopardy, because the issue is can we prosecute this offense? And under the treaty, the answer is no. And I do want to answer your questions with regard to jurisdiction, but I did, before I forget, I wanted to get back to one point I think that was raised by Judge Wilkins' question. We are not arguing for a same conduct test. We do recognize that the treaty provides for the same offenses cannot be prosecuted, and that the basis of that test has to be looking at the elements of the offenses. All we're saying is that in the context of comparing international offenses, you can't look to a strict Blockberger element-to-element test, and you can't completely ignore the underlying conduct. And I think that it's true that you can't completely ignore the underlying conduct in any double jeopardy issue. Because, for example, if a person is charged with murder in Belgium and murder in the United States, you always have to look to whether or not they're charged with the same underlying conduct, the same exact murder. And the international context, to use the Blockberger test and use elements that the government has attempted to use to distinguish these offenses, such as the connection to the U.S. persons and property as compared to the Belgian charge focusing on persons in general, doesn't make sense because that would distinguish every offense. The same is true with regard to the designation of the organization as a terrorist organization being the element in the United States, and the element in Belgium being an association formed to attack people or property.
But Ms. Petras, what about the element that United States law requires, which is that the organization be a foreign terrorist organization, not its designation per se by the United States, but that the kind of terrorism that the United States law is focusing on is foreign terrorism, and in Belgium it's not at all limited in that way?
But to distinguish the effect that to distinguish the associations or the element of the offenses on that basis is just a matter of terminology. Belgium is calling Al-Qaeda, in this case, an organization formed for the purpose of attacking people and property, whereas the United States is designating it as a foreign terrorist organization. I think when you're comparing elements of an international offense, the issue is whether or not they were prosecuting the same entity.
Prosecuting the same offense. And one is about foreign terrorist organizations, and the other is about associations or gangs. And to the extent that they overlap but have each areas of non-overlap, isn't that what we're looking for in applying the Blockberger analysis?
I don't think that that's the case, because with the fact that the Belgian law, when it criminalizes organizations, uses different terminology, does not change it from being the same in the sense that the U.S. designation as a foreign terrorist organization, if you look at those definitions, they are based on organizations that are formed for the purpose of attacking people and property. So in that sense, they are the same. They just haven't been designated by the United States as opposed to an organization within Belgium. So the issue here, and this is part of what we're saying with regard to using a strict Blockberger test in the international context, because here the offense clearly was the same. It's just that under the Belgian law, they call these organizations one thing, and under the U.S. law, they call them another thing. But we are talking about the same organization and the same types of organizations.
But that really goes back to sort of a Sindonia kind of analysis, which I thought you were acknowledging we should not apply.
there's a fine line, particularly here because you don't have to go so far as the test in Sidonia seemed to go, because the issue isn't just did they both charge an al-Qaeda offense, but are the criminal laws in Belgium and the criminal laws in the United States designed at targeting the same groups?
Right.
And the fact that they may not be precisely the same should not be enough to distinguish them for purposes of double jeopardy under the treaty, because you're never going to have a Belgian law that's going to define criminal organizations in the same exact way as the U.S. law is defining them. And the treaty itself recognizes that different terminology does not distinguish offenses for at least in the
So one country may use association and the other country may use conspiracy, and we're going to say that's equivalent. But where one country says conspiracy to kill U.S. nationals and our sovereign interest as the United States is in protecting U.S. nationals abroad, that seems to me that that's a sovereign interest that is not the interest that's asserted by Belgium in protecting the enumerated structures in its law, bridges and installations of various kinds.
I don't think the court can look to whether or not the U.S. has some sovereign interest, because any offense that the U.S. charges, particularly if there's extraterritorial jurisdiction, there's going to be a U.S. interest in doing it. Here, the way that the U.S. reaches to Belgium and gets offenses in Belgium is by only targeting offenses against U.S. nationals. But that description alone can't be enough to distinguish international offenses. Otherwise, there would always be such an element.
Not necessarily, because Blackburger requires non-overlap both ways. So if you have murder in Belgium, and then you have U.S. law that says we're going to ask for extradition when the murder that happened in Belgium was of a U.S. national, then that's going to be barred by Article 5, right?
And this is essentially no different, because what Belgium has charged is murder by explosion, essentially, because they have charged plotting to bomb something while people are present, which is a second-degree murder or a felony murder. And the charges here are under 2332B2 and under 1111A, which includes second-degree murder and felony murder. So this is no different than that, because Belgium has charged plotting to bomb something while people are present, and we have charged using a weapon of mass destruction, and the murder together, which together form the charge A in Belgium.
But our charge 1 has a conspiracy, and their charge A doesn't. Our charge 1 has a target of U.S. nationals, their charge A doesn't. Their charge A aims to bomb one of the enumerated structures. Our charge has nothing about structures. So it seems like under a Blackburger analysis, there's quite a bit to work with.
First of all, our charge A is a conspiracy. Our charge is a conspiracy. Their charge is a conspiracy. And I asked the court to look at the record on this, because we've submitted both the judgment in Belgium and the direct appeal in Belgium, both of which quote the charging document at the beginning. There are two cases together, so it's a little confusing, but the case in which Mr. Trabelsi was charged begins on page 359 of the record as to the judgment of the trial court in Belgium, and page 142 of the record as to the Court of Appeals decision in the direct appeal of Mr. Trabelsi's conviction in Belgium. That sets forth the charges in Belgium, and at the very beginning of it, it describes the ways in which he's charged with having committed the offenses, and specifically uses the word conspiracy. The only reason the district court made the mistake of saying that these were not conspiracy charges, because remember, the government was not arguing that below. The only reason he made the mistake was because it wasn't raised, and we never had the opportunity to say, look at the record, he was charged with conspiracy. We've spoken to the lawyers in Belgium. Here's what they've given us. These are what the charges were. And if you look at the description in the Court of Appeals decision of what the charges were, it specifically has a category called charges related to criminal conspiracy. So
I think part of the reason why there's so much deference paid by U.S. courts to foreign courts and ministers' determination of their laws, because comparative law is very sophisticated and easy to get wrong. But As I understand it, just reading the Belgian laws, they were charged under Trabelsi was charged under Belgian Criminal Code 520, 510, and 51 for charge A, which is the one that you're claiming overlaps with counts 1 and 2. And I don't see a conspiracy element in those laws.
But it's charged as a conspiracy.
Where does that come in?
It comes in at the beginning of the charging document. It lists the ways in which it is charged.
What
and it
work
says
does that
conspiracy.
Do in Belgium? Does it give you...
Pardon me?
What work does that do? Does it give you eligibility for more time? Is it just a method of proof? Is it like aiding and abetting? Why is it not codified?
I think the penalties are the same, but I'm told that's the way it's charged. And if you look at the charging document, it has conspiracy in it. If you look at the, and while we may not understand it, and it may not have been the same way we would charge a conspiracy for charge A, the documents demonstrate that it clearly was, because if you look at the opinion, it describes the conspiracy that was charged, that he was convicted of, and it states conspiracy as the means by which he was accused of having committed the offense. Also, even if you had a doubt about that, if you look at charge D, he was specifically charged with being an instigator of an association formed for the purposes of attacking people and property, which is the same as count 1, attacking people, and count 2, attacking people and property by explosion when you add in the charge.
But if the Belgian courts have reached the conclusion that even if we assume that they understood that it was a conspiracy under Belgian law, that it wasn't the same conspiracy within kind of a Blockberger type analysis, how are we to just ignore their interpretation of their own law?
Because they weren't interpreting their own law, they were interpreting both laws, and they did not find that the distinction was a conspiracy in the United States and no conspiracy in Belgium. That's not at all what they found. What they found was essentially that it was a different conspiracy, because they took out overt acts 23 through 26, which it appears from the record they believed changed the nature of what Mr. Trabelsi could be convicted of in the U.S. In fact, they were wrong about U.S. law, not about Belgian law. They were wrong on their understanding of what that did to the U.S. charges, because in practice it did nothing, because the government is using the same plot to destroy Kleinbruegel, and there is no other evidence other than the plot to destroy Kleinbruegel.
But isn't that the distinction between the first level of decision and the second level of decision and then the final level of decision? I mean, isn't that part of the difficulty that you're taking us into? I thought first your argument in part was, given the provision in Article 5, it's not the same as a Blockberger test for purposes of double jeopardy, and that while we find Blockberger to be an easy test to apply, that's not the concept that Article 5 was addressing. So then that takes us down the road of trying to understand these two different legal systems. And some of the questions you've been answering this morning, it seems to me, suggest that either we're going down this very difficult road you're suggesting, or we're pretty close to the other end, saying we take the Belgian minister and the document at what it said, and if in our legal system we are satisfied under a Blockberger test that there are different elements, that is sufficient under the treaty. And I'm not suggesting that Belgium knows we have a Blockberger test, but there is some respect for different legal systems in the way they approach charges. And if a country wants to be very specific about something, it can. But if it isn't, then there is this deference that kicks in international comedy.
Well, that if you give that deference to Belgium in this case, then you will be allowing them to interpret our law, which we've never in any case deferred to a foreign court's interpretation of what the U.S. law is. You'd be deferring to their decision as to what the U.S. charges were. This court is in no different position to compare the Belgian offenses to the U.S. offenses than the Belgian court was. And to completely allow them to do it would be allow them to make the mistake that such as they made here.
No, but the record we have before us was that the first level tried to distinguish the nature of the conspiracies by eliminating certain overt acts. That was not followed through.
It was, and that's the government's misrepresentation with regard to what the Belgian system is. And if you look at the record in all of these opinions, it's clear. Because the first step is the same as it is in the United States. The prosecutor has to go to the magistrate judge and say, is this warrant enforceable? That's the very first step, and that's the only way anybody can be extradited. They did that in Belgium. They went to the Belgian court, and that court took out those overt acts. That eliminating those overt acts remained through the entire process, all the way to the Belgian minister's decision.
I thought when it went up to the Court of Appeals, they didn't do that.
No, they didn't. It wasn't challenged in the Court of Appeals. That would have been the Belgian government's decision to challenge the removal of those overt acts. And the Belgian Court of Appeals decision, following in the extradition case, which is at, I'll find it, but that first Court of Appeals decision specifically said, and this is cited in our brief, that removal of those overt acts isn't before the court because the Belgian government didn't challenge that. So the Belgian government was stuck with that all the way through. And even if you go to the Minister of Justice's decision, he begins with, given that, we've removed those overt acts 23 through 26, which all demonstrates that the Belgians made a mistake as to what the U.S. law
was. Well, the minister refers to those, but interprets it slightly differently from how you're characterizing. The minister says you couldn't prosecute for acts 23 through 26 as themselves criminal. But you could consider them as evidence or overt acts or components of the broader conspiracy, which is, and the United States seems satisfied with that. And
they seem satisfied with that because they know, unlike what the Belgians apparently didn't know, that they can simply prove the more narrow conspiracy, even though they've charged U.S. citizens wherever they may be. They can go in, present the evidence, because the Belgians are allowing them to present the evidence.
But I don't think that's in conflict with the minister. What the minister's opinion contemplates. Do you?
Yes, because if you look at what the minister's opinion contemplates and what all the Belgian decisions contemplate is that they've charged, the United States has charged some broader conspiracy, some other conspiracy, and it even says in the opinions, unconnected to Belgium. But that's not what they've charged here. They've charged the same conspiracy. That's the other reason why the court has to look to the facts when comparing offenses in this case, because you're comparing conspiracies. The government cannot break up one conspiracy into multiple separate offenses, and that's what they're doing here. And they seem to have done it by confusing the Belgians into thinking that it's a separate conspiracy, but it's the same conspiracy. It's the same actors. It's the same Al-Qaeda plot. It's the same evidence. It's the same events, and the underlying charges to murder and to use a weapon of mass destruction and a bomb are all the same. So for those reasons, it's one big conspiracy. They charged, even if you look at it as they only charge part of it in Belgium, they can't now charge it saying wherever they may be. And particularly here it's offensive because they're only using the evidence of Klein Bruegel, even though they've labeled it wherever may be.
All right, why don't we hear from the government?
Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, Peter Smith on behalf of the United States. I would like to address a few of the points that appellant's counsel made as she was wrapping up. But first, I want to make the overall point that this court should not review appellant's claim. Belgium considered and rejected the arguments that appellant is making now. The Casey decision indicates reasons why this court ought to grant the decision of the Belgian government deference. Those reasons are persuasive and powerful. They include comity and respect for foreign relations, Belgium is our equal treaty partner in the bilateral treaty, and this court ought to recognize that treaty obligation extends to the Belgian decision. Were we to extradite someone to a foreign country like Belgium, we would not want the foreign authorities to second-guess our decision here.
Mr. Smith, the Casey decision in dicta said we owe great deference to the foreign government's interpretation. What is our role? Is it rubber stamp? How do we conceive of the role that we have here?
I think that in a nutshell, the role would be that the court would satisfy itself that certain prerequisites are met. First of all, you would evaluate appellant's claim. It is a double jeopardy claim that arises under the treaty. You would look at the treaty to ensure that that is a provision of the treaty. You would look at what Belgium did. It extradited. You would look at its grant of extradition, and you would look at the fact that it ruled on these questions, and that would be the end of the court's inquiry. The court would not...
So we don't care what it said?
This court wouldn't look behind Belgium's decision.
Suppose the United States agreed to extradite a person here on offenses A, B, and C, and he's extradited to Belgium, and Belgium decides to prosecute him on offenses A, B, C, and D. And suppose the United States has just finished prosecuting on D, and he's just been released after serving his time on D. Now, I just wanted to put it in the sense of the United States might have an interest as distinct from where the receiving end. And to what extent would we contemplate that the Belgian court would even inquire and understand whether or not that decision by the United States to extradite contemplated that there could be a prosecution in Belgium on offense D? And what I understand from the government is really the court has no role.
Well, I think your suggestion, Judge Rogers, is compatible with the government's position, because there is an important distinction between the situation where the United States is extraditing a defendant and that defendant would have review here versus the situation in this case where Trabelsi is being extradited to the United States.
But what I was trying to highlight is what is the nature of the inquiry by the inquiring court? Now, we're after extradition. Casey was before extradition. Other courts have looked at this after extradition, many times in the context of habeas, and other times actually after trial. But I gather the government is not resisting the notion that Article 5 is in the nature of a double jeopardy protection which a defendant may invoke?
We are not resisting the suggestion that that Article 5 is a double jeopardy type of claim, that it is similar to Abney. But what we are saying is that there's a predicate or ancillary question, which is whether the court even has jurisdiction to review.
That's what I'm trying to ask. You said we shouldn't, and I wondered whether you were acknowledging, but we have jurisdiction.
No.
But once we have jurisdiction, then we should exercise comment.
No, we're suggesting the court lacks jurisdiction, that the court would only have the authority to inquire on the papers in the manner that I mentioned.
What about Johnson?
Can I just be clear? Even to do that, don't we have to have jurisdiction?
I don't think necessarily, because supposing the court lacks subject matter jurisdiction, it still has to evaluate the papers and the parties and the claim in order to satisfy itself that it lacks subject matter jurisdiction.
No, but your statement about we shouldn't inquire means he loses as distinct from...
No, I understand. And perhaps I misspoke, but what I'm saying is the court lacks jurisdiction to do more than that. But, and I would suggest that in many of the cases that have evaluated claims on the merits, they've taken one of two strategies. They've either the parties haven't raised the issue and the court hasn't addressed it, or they've said this is a complicated question and they've set it aside and said the merits are simple, so we're going to address the merits. And if I may, I would like to do that.
Can I understand your position? Because it seems like you're saying something different now than what you said in your briefs. Are you saying that we do not have jurisdiction to hear this appeal at all?
We're suggesting that, and we did say that in our brief, and then we took the position that at a minimum, under the Casey decision, the court had to grant at least great deference to the decision of the Belgian court. But the primary argument was that the court shouldn't review it. What I'd like to do is pivot to some of the factual claims.
No, but before you pivot, I just need to be clear where we are, because I know where you want us to end up. But I want to know whether what the path there is. If you're acknowledging that a treaty is the law of the United States and that Article 5 includes a double jeopardy protection that a defendant facing prosecution in this country following extradition may invoke, then why are we not in the Abney-type situation?
Where we differ, Your Honor, is in the last part of your suggestion, that we think that given those set of facts that the defendant would be in the position of any other defendant in the United States. The fact that the treaty is the law of land doesn't mean that a defendant may assert any claim at any time.
No, but I'm just clear. I mean, Casey leaves this open.
It does.
He's in this country having been extradited by Belgium at our request. And he's claiming that while you can prosecute him on a lot of things, there's some things you can't prosecute
him
on.
Right. And he fully litigated that in Belgium.
I understand. But now he's here, and Casey left this open. All right? And I just need to understand, what is Article 5? If it isn't something that a defendant has a right to invoke.
Sure. Article 5 could be seen in a variety of ways. And I would suggest that it is a provision that governs the roles of the two sovereigns. So it doesn't necessarily mean that a defendant has legal rights under that provision. And even if he did, they would be in Belgium. And that's the basis of our argument. This, in part, answers Judge Wilkins' question.
I don't understand. If Belgium and the United States enter a treaty that says any person we agree to extradite under this treaty will have the protection of double jeopardy, let me just say it that way,
right,
in shorthand, if and when they are prosecuted in the receiving country. I understand the two countries could duke it out, but what's the purpose of having that in a treaty if it's not to afford some protection to the person who's actually the subject of the request and the transfer?
In that situation, then the treaty itself would authorize the court to engage in a sort of double jeopardy analysis. But the treaty here doesn't say that. It says that a person can't be prosecuted for the same offense of conviction in the requested state, which is Belgium. And appellant litigated this repeatedly, and we can talk about how he did that. But Belgium made a final determination. The Minister of Justice granted extradition. That was affirmed by the Council of State. The United States obtained a diplomatic note, which is the decision of the government of Belgium explaining that the result of all this was that the overt acts were not excluded, that appellant could be tried on the government's indictment, on the offenses, that the Belgian authorities had compared the offenses in the two countries and were satisfied that there was no double jeopardy issue as under the treaty. And as I mentioned before, that would be the end of the court's inquiry. But appellant has made a lot of other claims that I do want to address.
We're going to give you time to address them. But let me just ask on this point, we do have authorities in the context of specialty or specialité or however it's referred to in diplomatic relations that allows the receiving court to inquire, like Johnson versus Brown. And it seems like there's a separate question whether the prosecution that is proposed in the United States is consistent with the extradition. It's not that we're reviewing and questioning what Brussels did for its own satisfaction. It's that we have an obligation under Blockburger to make sure that the prosecution here is consistent in our view. But I think that's a very... So again, we have some ability. I mean, let's say once he comes here, we have 100% deference to the minister's decision. He's extradited. He's here. And instead, there's a superseding indictment that charges him for the absolute closest analog in the United States to the Belgian laws under which he was prosecuted. Presumably that would be a Johnson versus Brown problem, no?
Well, I guess I have at least two responses to your suggestion. And one is that double jeopardy and specialty are quite different. The specialty claim only arises after extradition, and it has all to do with what the government of the United States is doing. The double jeopardy issue under the treaty, not the standard Blockburger inquiry of a United States defendant, but under the treaty, is are the offenses the same? And that is a question for the extraditing, the country from which the defendant is being extradited, in our view. And specialty is distinguishable because it's a claim that arises later, unlike this claim, we would argue.
Why?
Because...
Why is it different in that way?
It wouldn't be clear until the government actually began its prosecution or even engaged in the prosecution what happened. And even if the court didn't think that that was sufficient...
Isn't it structurally just the same, where in order to get the extradition, the U.S. executive branch makes a proffer, whether under specialty or under double jeopardy? And that's what the foreign sovereign looks at. And so it's really structurally very closely analogous.
But here we would be addressing specialty, and in the double jeopardy context, Belgium has already addressed that and would address that, just like we would if we were sending someone. So it has to do with who under the treaty is responsible for the inquiry. But my second argument is, even if the court disagreed with that and thought the inquiries were the same, this court in Lope Sierra, for example, said that the question of whether a defendant can even raise specialty is open.
I don't follow that. So if Belgium has a privacy protection that we don't recognize that could raise a specialty problem, you know, we want someone to be extradited from Belgium. Belgium is the one that's going to examine the specialty issue and put a halt to that. No, not us. You say it's a different sovereign.
Wait, that sounds more like a dual criminality problem.
I mean, it's a dual criminality problem.
So specialty
would
be,
is what we're...
There's a grant of extradition. The United States government has gone beyond that.
And we're exceeding it.
Or here, for example, we obtained another superseding indictment. We added a whole new charge.
Right. Or like in Johnson versus Brown, they say we won't extradite him for
right.
that. And we say, how about for this? And then they extradite him. And we say, we've got him for that.
Exactly. So that's why I'm saying that would arise later. And that is contemplated that the United States government may adjudicate that claim. But the second part of my response is, even if the court disagreed that that was somehow distinguishable, it's not even clear that a defendant can raise a specialty claim. In Lope Sierra, just a few years ago, this court said that was an open question. Some circuits have allowed such claims to go forward. It's clear that this court would lack jurisdiction over such a claim on interlocutory review. I don't know of any circuit that allows that. If the specialty claim were allowed to go forward, it would be following conviction during direct appeal. And defendant, and this I guess goes back to my Casey point before, appellant will have those sorts of rights in the future subject to trial and conviction. He would have a direct appeal. So he can vindicate his other rights. The only thing that we're talking about here is the double jeopardy analysis, the comparison of the offenses. Belgium has done that.
Tell us more about the, like, step back and the context. What is the, whose interests are being served and how in having Article 5? I have to say it was very striking to me that in your brief you mentioned only torture and trade secrets as potentially the targets of this, and that seemed very limited to me.
Oh, there we were just giving an example of sort of overlapping claims, and you know, the court earlier mentioned murder, and that could be similar given extraterritorial jurisdiction if there was just a murder committed by or against an American citizen. But, you know, both countries could prosecute that. That may be barred under the treaty, and, you know, would beg how one would analyze that. But if Belgium...
But the interest, sort of what... Why is Article 5 in there? Whose interest is it serving?
It's the countries. The countries have contracted. They have entered into the treaty with certain expectations. The rights belong to the countries. And so, you know, for example, some circuits allow a country to waive a specialty claim.
Is Article 5 waivable in your view?
We think it could be. You know, it hasn't been addressed by the parties. I think it could be. And certainly, appellant would be in the court's hypothetical earlier today where the question was, supposing Belgium did something that was hinky in terms of the extradition. You know, our response would be, first of all, this court doesn't review the Belgian decision. But second of all, he's had that review. If the Minister of Justice did something funny, the Council of State is responsible for reviewing that decision, which is what happened here.
Let's suppose the Minister of Justice and all of the courts did some sort of a Blockberger analysis, and they said that the elements were different, and they based their analysis on of the elements of the U.S. statute on a lower court decision. And after the extradition happens, the Supreme Court interprets the statute completely contrary to that lower court decision, and based on the Supreme Court's interpretation, Blockberger would apply. We should just ignore what the Supreme Court says and give deference to an erroneous Belgian interpretation.
This court should, but appellant would have the ability to make those arguments in Belgium. So he brought this, not only the same claim, he made these same arguments in Belgium. He made the arguments that the offenses were different. He explained why. He had review to numerous courts. And if I'm understanding that...
So if his reviews in Belgium were exhausted and he's extradited and he's brought here... We can't review it. Our response would be, you know, try to argue that back in Belgium and get so that you can get sent back. But we are powerless to do anything. That's how you would have us write that opinion.
I think so, although I would, and I haven't thought this through fully, but I guess I would say that the court can take comfort in the fact that once appellant is here and the double jeopardy question had been resolved, he would still have all the rights of any other defendant in the United States. So he would be able to raise claims on direct appeal. He would be able to raise collateral claims.
But I thought your argument is that, I mean, double jeopardy doesn't apply with different sovereigns. That's why you have state prosecutions and federal prosecutions for the same time.
Right.
The only reason that he's got any protections here is because of the treaty, right? So to the extent that that he has any double jeopardy rights that can be recognized, it's because they were granted to him by the treaty. So who gets to say whether the treaty is being complied with?
I guess the short answer to your question is he would not have that recourse for a number of different reasons. One is, are the jurisdictional questions that I mentioned. He could raise those arguments in Belgium, But Belgium is also applying its own law and its own procedures to the extradition. So it's not even clear to me that if the Supreme Court said something about double jeopardy that post-dated the Belgian determination, that that would be relevant to what Belgium
did. Why
wouldn't
it be? I mean, they say the Belgian highest court says that we find that for charge A, the elements are 1, 2, and 3. And under the U.S. Offense, the elements are A, B, and C. And there's difference applying the Blockberger test. And therefore, based on that, we extradite this gentleman to the United States. And then the Supreme Court says, well, the elements to the U.S. offense aren't A, B, and C. There's something else. And if we were to look at that, we would say Blockberger no longer applies because the Supreme Court lopped off element C, let's say. They just said it's element A and B.
Right.
That would have no relevance at that point because it just happened to come too late, so it's not relevant?
It would seem so because the claim there would be that appellant would be asking this court to review the legal determination of the Belgian government, of the Belgian authorities, and I'm not aware of any authority that would allow this court to do that. I mean, Casey makes clear that even if, setting aside the jurisdictional question, even if this court were to grant great deference to the decision of a foreign sovereign, that this court does not review legal errors of a foreign sovereign. And that's exactly what that would be.
I know you're urging us not to get there, but assuming that we do want to understand the nature of the application of Article 5 under Blockberger to these counts, can you just walk us through on count 1 versus Belgian charge A, the element that count 1 includes that Belgian charge A doesn't? Conspiracy?
Conspiracy would be 1, correct, an agreement. And I'm going to respond not by repeating our brief, but I'm going to respond to what appellant's counsel argued this morning. And she argued that Belgian had charged appellant with a conspiracy. She was focusing on U.S. count 1. She said that had to do with the way he was charged in Belgium. And my response is that you look at the offenses. Article 51, it's cited, this is explained on page 34 of the government's brief, says that is an attempt. An attempt is clearly different from a conspiracy because a conspiracy requires an agreement. Appellant has cited a lot of language. That, to me, sounds a lot like aiding and abetting, where people cooperate to do something. That doesn't mean it's a conspiracy. Even if the court did not buy that argument and concluded, and again, addressing the merits, setting aside all these other issues about Casey, that the court weren't convinced of that, you would have two different conspiracies. The scope is different, the time is different, the object of the conspiracy is different. There are many differences. And in fact, going beyond count 1, the United States indictment charges 3 different conspiracies. One of the differences the court suggested earlier today, what in terms of the count 3 and 4 of the United States indictment, is terrorism. And I would make the following point. It is not just a matter of the lexicon that the countries are using. The government has charged a crime of terrorism. Terrorism is defined in the U.S. Code as involving a political purpose. 2332B, I think it is, defines terrorism as an attempt to influence the government. Now, Belgium charged appellant with offenses relating to an association of wrongdoers or membership in a criminal gang. That is clearly not the same thing. One can be a member of a criminal gang or a criminal association that has nothing to do with terrorism, and it doesn't have a political purpose.
The political purpose, I don't recall you emphasizing that in your brief. And there's a provision of the treaty that steers clear of political
question. But that's different from whether the offenses are the same.
Let me ask you, I assume you're also relying on, so you're relying on conspiracy, not being present in the Belgian charge, killing U.S. nationals?
Killing U.S. nationals, the timing of the conspiracy
the
is different.
Timing and scope and object, that sounds like it's getting into the sort of the Sindonia analysis. That's not in the law. That's in the facts.
One would have to look at our argument is essentially Blackburger. It's the same elements test. One looks at the offenses. It gets slightly more complicated in conspiracy because one would look at the scope of the object of the conspiracy or the conspiratorial agreement. That would distinguish one conspiracy from another.
Right. It's like her point about if it's murder, the fact that it's murder on your books and their books, if it's not the same person, it's not, you can't apply Blackburger and, there. So here you're saying, the facts come in to play in this limited way in the sense of, are we even talking about the same thing here? But I'm not sure that I'm see where the scope is so different. I mean, that's where you get into these charges 23, 24, 25, 26, and that's really the heart of the U.S. case as well.
Well, again, comparing count one, because there's three different conspiracies. Count one conspiracy, appellant argues, is the same as the Belgian charges because it involves, according to him, a plot to blow up the Klein-Brogel military base. The United States charges include 28 separate overt acts. They involve training. They involve acts that occurred in Pakistan and Afghanistan. They involve involvement in al-Qaeda, the fact that appellant is an al-Qaeda operative. They involve attacks that would be sort of mobile, where it wasn't just Klein-Brogel, but it was the fact that depending on the needs of al-Qaeda, I guess, and that's paraphrasing, appellant would be sent to various locations or places.
All right,
limited.
So you said there were three conspiracies. Can you just tell us what you're...
Sure. The other charged conspiracy is, and again, each of these would be distinguished because they involve an agreement. So even there, and the Belgian charges do not, so even there we would prevail under Blackburger. The second conspiracy is the weapon of mass destruction. And there you have... again, a different object of the conspiracy. It's not simply to blow up the Klein-Brogel military base, and it's not simply to use one method at one time in one place. It is different. It's simply a different conspiracy. It involves a weapon of mass destruction that could be used at a different time or a different place. The third conspiracy involves...
Could be, but was it charged? Were there facts given in the indictment that
were... Well, if you look back at the first... If you look at the overt acts, and again, I mean, I appreciate the point about, our theory is you look at the offenses. You look at the offenses themselves. Yeah. And there you have an agreement.
Weapons of mass destruction.
Right. You have of a certain type, and you have
one overt act
or one substantial step. So those are the offenses, and those themselves are different. But when one looks at the object of the conspiracy.
And what does the Belgian have that the U.S. doesn't have?
In
charge A, count two. Blackburger requires us to have both elements in the U.S. that aren't in the Belgian and elements in the Belgian that aren't in the U.S. And
Belgium
has said weapons of mass destruction, the agreement, Belgium has knowledge of someone present.
Knowledge of someone present.
Enumerated structures.
So that's distinguishable. Structures is distinguishable. The Klein-Brogel military base and the use of a bomb are all different. Weapon of mass destruction is broader. It could be something different, and it could be used at a different place or a different time.
Could be, but you're talking about the same chemicals. You don't have any evidence of a different weapon of mass destruction. You're talking about the same chemicals. So that's, you're slipping out of the formal...
The offense, because into the facts. Right, we're looking at the object of the agreement. But when you're looking at the offenses, you would still... come to the same result for the reasons that we just discussed.
I actually find counts three and four harder.
Yeah. And that's material support for...
Because they, you've charged in count three conspiracy to provide support to a foreign terrorist organization. and they've charged in charge D an association formed to injure persons or property. There's a conspiracy aspect there. There's an association or gang intending to use force. One distinction, I guess, is conspiracy versus instigator, but he's not found to have been an instigator. Does that matter?
It doesn't matter. First of all, one distinguishing element would be the conspiracy, the agreement. Another distinguishing...
Although here they do charge conspiracy, don't they? Agreement.
Well, we would argue it's not the same. But even if they were two conspiracies, they're different conspiracies. But the reason they're not necessarily the same is that on an aiding and abetting theory, you can agree with someone to do something, but the conspiracy charge is different because it's punishing the agreement. It's not punishing the act. Well,
but Belgian charge D is association formed to injure persons or property, and it's under Belgian Criminal Code 322, conspiracy 323, association to commit crime. So that one seems quite explicitly also focusing on an agreement. Not so?
It doesn't mean that it's a conspiracy in that formal sense. But even if the court thought that they were two conspiracies and interpreted count D as a conspiracy, it's still different. The conspiracy in the United States is material support to a foreign terrorist organization. So it requires material support. That's not an element of the Belgian offense. And it requires a terrorism, which, as defined in the U.S. Code, is not simply a group or a gang or a criminal purpose. It's more than that. It's a political purpose to influence the government.
If there's foreign terrorist organization is differentiates the United States, what in Belgium is required that's not required in the U.S. for Blockburger purposes? I'm not sure I see that.
Well, in association of wrongdoers would be something different. That would be a requirement that would not be in the
U.S.
Hasn't
the treaty itself talked about association of wrongdoers being tantamount to being the Belgian equivalent of conspiracy?
No. I mean, the treaty language is in Article 2. It's not in Article 5. It uses the word or in between those two things, and you also need to consider the purpose of the treaty. Article 2's purpose is, the whole purpose of the treaty is to encourage extradition. So Article 2 is saying, look, in the dual criminality context, we interpret that broadly. We want to bring people in. We interpret double jeopardy narrowly because that excludes folks from being extradited to the United States, and we want to interpret that narrowly. And that's consistent with the purpose of the treaty, the Senate report. So the purpose of the treaty refutes the argument that those things are the same in the treaty, as does the use of the word or in Article 2. So they are, in fact, different, and it's not simply a matter of nomenclature.
And you don't have anything else to differentiate the Belgian from the U.S. on charge?
Belgian charge D is the association of wrongdoing.
Yeah. I guess, the hardest one I think is count 4 and Q. Intending to use force, you can do terrorism without intending to use force?
Those things are different for the reason that I said. Terrorism has a political purpose as an element, so that would be an element of the U.S. offense. It is not an element of the Belgian offense. The Belgian offense is...
But isn't private organizations intending to use force? That's a subset of
it could be,
terrorist organizations.
Right, but that's not dispositive, because here we're talking about conspiracies. We're talking about the elements are not the same. There can be overlap of conspiracies. Dixon and Felix make that clear. So the question isn't whether there's overlap. The question is it the same conspiracy? And it's not the same conspiracy. Belgian count Q involves membership in a private militia, the purpose of the private militia being to use force. It could be a subset, but that doesn't mean that there's a double jeopardy problem.
What I'm asking for is the Blockburger step that shows it to not be wholly included within. So you don't want it to be a subset if it's going to satisfy Blockburger, right?
My response is there could be overlap.
Right, but you have to point to something that's penalized by the Belgian law that isn't by the U.S.
And you're saying it's the non-political group
the association
that are seeking to use force.
Distinguishable. The U.S. requires material support, requires material support to a foreign terrorist organization. So those are two things that are different. So what's different in the Belgian count Q is membership in a private militia. That's not required in the U.S. count. And the purpose to use force is different. Material support could be...
Why is the purpose to use force different?
Well, the U.S. code defines material support as can be something less than using force. It defines it as being, for example, providing money to a foreign terrorist organization. That would be
But the organization has to have a purpose to use force or not. It
could
have a purpose to use threats.
It could or could not. Those things are distinguishable. They're different. And my point is that
I think you and I are saying slightly different things, though. I'm saying that the organization, you look at the purpose of the organization. Yes, somebody can be providing material support by giving money, but if you're associating with them or conspiring with them, that's about the support you're giving. But the group, the definition of the group is in Belgium, a purpose to use force, and in the U.S., a purpose to use force and or threats
or coercion or... So the two are not necessarily the same. They're distinguishable.
The Trebelsi's lawyer has said that it seems like the treatment within the Belgian system of the exclusion of Acts 23 through 26 kind of shifted as the case went up. And that there's a case to be made for that originally that lower courts were saying, well, they're not going to prosecute him for this. And then by the time it gets into the hands of the minister, it's sort of, well, yeah, you can use that evidence. You can use those acts. You just can't, those can't be the separate offenses. What is the point, as you understand it, of Belgium having taken the trouble to exclude 23 through 26?
Well, I can't answer the question of what the initial point was, but my response would be initially they seemed to exclude those counts, but by the time the Minister of Justice made the determination, which is the grant of extradition, that was not an exclusion. And that was affirmed by the Council of State, and the diplomatic note makes clear that there is no such exclusion. So,
well, they do still talk about it as if they're affirming it, and, oh, yes, there's that exclusion, and, well, what does it mean? And so if we're asking us to do anything other than a complete rubber stamp, we have to have some non-arbitrary way of describing what that's about.
I guess I have two responses. One is that the Belgian courts, the Belgian system, followed its course. So, and again, we've discussed why the United States thinks the court shouldn't even inquire.
Which is sort of a process-based argument. Okay.
Aside. So we're saying, look, the initial courts basically made a mistake. They looked at the overt acts as being a charge, and the Minister of Justice said, well, that's not the way we compare the offenses. You look at the elements of the offenses and see if they're the same. That's what the treaty requires. The Minister of Justice corrected a mistake in these earlier court decisions. That's how the process is supposed to work. Appellant raised arguments throughout this process. They were rejected. The Minister of Justice's view is set forth in appendix pages 583 and 584. It makes clear that the subject is the offenses and the elements, that the overt acts are not excluded, that the United States can raise that as evidence during trial. And appellant was arguing this morning that those are still excluded, and that we disagree with that. That's incorrect. It's refuted by page 584 of the record. The Council of State went on to affirm the decision of the Minister of Justice, and it uses the same language about the offenses, the fact that the government can use other evidence, it can use all of its evidence. The diplomatic note specifically references the overt acts 23 through 26 and says the government can use those. So if there were any question at all about the meaning of these various court decisions and government decisions, the definitive view of the Belgian government, which is expressed in the diplomatic note, is as the government, the United States government, is arguing to you now, which should give you solace that there was not, in fact, this mistake. Again, setting aside the issue about whether this court would even review that or reach that question.
I think I might have missed your transition. You said there were two reasons. One of them was that the Belgian system had followed its course, and the other one was that...
Well, that the factual record actually refutes... I mean, I see these as two different things. One is that the initial courts did accept these overt acts, and they were essentially overruled or reversed or vacated by later decisions. And the later decisions are the correct ones. And the second part of my response is because how do we know that? We know that because the record has the plain language of the Minister of Justice decision. It includes the plain language of the Council of State decision. And if there were any question about any of those things, we have the diplomatic note, which is the expression of the government of Belgium's view about this particular question.
Anything further? You okay? Anything you want to add quickly?
I don't think so. Thank you very much. We urge the court to affirm the judgment of the district court in this case. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
What government counsel just said is essentially would be the same as Belgian lawyers standing up before a Belgian court and saying the attorney general overruled the magistrate judge in his extradition decision. He couldn't do that, and neither could the Belgian Minister of Justice overrule the courts. There's a process. They took the warrant to decide, and to be clear, what the diplomatic note says is you can use the evidence. It does not say that you can prosecute him for the offense in overt acts 23 through 26. Those overt acts were excluded from the beginning, and nothing changed. It was never overruled. And if you look to the Belgian Minister of Justice's opinion, counsel just cited to it on 584, go two pages before that, and it says, given the removal of the overt acts, the prosecuting authority had no authority to change what the court said about how the warrant was enforceable, which was the original decision. It wasn't appealed as to the exclusions for 23 through 26. That stands. The confusion seems to be in the fact that in this case, as in every case, even if you exclude something from extradition, you say you can have him for offense A, B, and C, but you can't have him for offense D. When he goes to be prosecuted for A, B, and C, you can use the evidence of offense D as other crimes evidence or evidence of the charged offenses in any other way you want to. And that's always what the Belgians have been saying. You can use the Klein-Bruegel evidence to prove your other charge. But they made the mistake of thinking that there was some other charge. And the problem here is that there isn't.
The government's Blockberger analysis that the otherness of the charge is something we measure by Blockberger. We don't measure it by a kind of transaction or occurrence, Sidonia type analysis. And here, the thing that distinguishes it is it's quite formal, but it's the foreign terrorist organization, it's the U.S. people being involved, it's that the Belgian law looks at intent to use force against structures. They're not fully overlapping. They have aspects that are not replicated in the other law. And so the fact that they are really focusing on, as a big part of the case, both prosecutions, the Klein-Bruegel efforts, but in ways that are different offenses.
Because they're both conspiracy offenses, and even in the U.S., when you compare conspiracies, you have to look at the underlying facts. You have to look at whether that they're the same people, the same places, whether it's a common goal, look at the interdependence among the participants and the overlap among the participants. Here, it is the same exact conspiracy. It's the same group of people doing the same things for the same purpose.
But in a
purpose.
Way, you're answering a question that's one step further down the road from where I think the United States would stop you, and they would say, well, you know, if it was like murder here, murder there, then we'd look and see, is it the same person, or conspiracy here, conspiracy there, then we'd look and say, well, it's got to be the same conspiracy or not, and if it's not, then, It's different. But they're saying, well, no, it's not conspiracy there, conspiracy here. It is this type of crime there and that type of crime here, so we're not past Blockburger, so we're not even getting into your question. Because we're not worried that we've got the same offense, but we're barring prosecution because it's actually a different person that was killed.
They are the same offenses. The main thing that the government just said was that in the U.S. there are terrorism offenses and talked about terrorism offenses being political offenses. That's not an element of any of the offenses. Nowhere is it an element. The only
foreign terrorist organization. It has to be foreign.
Right, but it has to be a designated organization. That's the difference, because it has to be a designated organization, whereas in Belgium it only had to be this certain kind of association. What we're asking the court to do is just look at what is a designated organization. It's an organization that uses force against people or property. So it's all, they are the same in that respect. They target the same types of organizations. They're both here targeting Al-Qaeda, and to say because we call it a designated terrorist organization, but they're calling Al-Qaeda an association formed to attack persons or properties, he can be prosecuted at the same time. It's not what double jeopardy intended. Double jeopardy is to face like the Razak situation where they charged murder, and here we were charging air piracy that had to do with airplanes and other elements that aren't the same. Here, the elements are the same. They're just called different things.
But in the bank robbery, I mean, even if you have a D.C. prosecution for armed robbery and then a federal prosecution for bank robbery, and they're both at the same time here in U.S. District Court, there's no double jeopardy issue there, right? Because a bank robbery federal statute requires it to be a federally insured institution, et cetera. So you could prosecute the guy for armed robbery and bank robbery for the exact same act, right? No Blockburger problem.
Well, there would be the armed aspect, but if the only difference was the federally insured and robbery, yes, you could prosecute that, putting aside the fact that they're separate sovereigns, D.C. and the U.S., and they haven't negotiated as the sovereign.
They're the same sovereign. It's U.S. is the same sovereign. It's Superior Court or the D.C. co-defense.
I understand. I thought the court was using separate states. But even if the only difference is the federally insured, yes, you can't. What we're asking is that if you look at the treaty and if you use that same very strict Blockburger test for international offenses, you're always going to have that problem. And the parties to the treaty have negotiated that away because they've said you don't look to essential jurisdictional elements. That is under the dual criminality provision, but I think you can consider that when you consider what they meant by the same offenses. And if you say that they meant because we're calling them U.S. citizens, that would also allow the court's example of murder because it's a U.S. citizen and murder because it's a Belgian citizen, when it is the same offense, if you allow that distinction to be the distinction. The problem is that in an international context, there would be no purpose for the double jeopardy provision then. And then to get to the court's jurisdictional questions, the parties here to the treaty negotiated and contracted for the rights of the people that they have control over. We want our U.S. citizens to have the same right not to be prosecuted in Belgium that we have not to be prosecuted here. And if you accept the government's argument and completely defer to the Belgians, that would mean a U.S. citizen could be sent to Belgium and we would have no control over the fact that if we made a mistake about Belgian law and the Belgians are saying, well, that's not really what the law is, but we're still going to prosecute them because you made that mistake. And the fact that the Belgians made a mistake here, if you look at the record on page 554, and that the only reason that they extradited here was because they misunderstood the nature of the conspiracy, they specifically say that the U.S. bases its prosecution on the existence of a larger criminal conspiracy than only the criminal conspiracy in the Belgian file. And then they refer to, they say that the purpose of the offense considered by the American authorities is broader than the reference alone to the attempt to destroy Klein Bruegel and is based on elements having nothing to do with Belgium. And then it refers to the Bagel conspiracy and the Richard Reed conspiracy, which is not the evidence here. The Belgians made a mistake in thinking that this was a different conspiracy. It's the same actors, the same offenses. The only distinctions being the way that, what they call the organization and the and the U.S. Nationality.
All right. Anything further?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you. We'll take the case under advisement.